Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Overall, the first three quarters of 2023 have been really good for equipment manufacturers, and those are reflected in the tractor and combine report. AEM, as you know, puts out the tractor and combine report every month. We've been doing so for the last 35 years or so, where we show the sales of tractors and combines of various classes.
Kurt Blade, Senior Vice President of Agricultural Services with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, or AEM.
And for the month of September, or really showing the first three quarters of the year, we're showing that some of those key markets like self-propelled combines, articulated four-wheel drive tractors, and those tractors over 100 horsepower are all showing pretty significant growth year over year.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Four-wheel drive tractors, those big tractors are up about 40% for the first three quarters of the year. They're up 100% for the month of September.
Kurt Blades is Senior Vice President of Agricultural Services with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
But that's, that could be a timing issue. But the real number is, we're showing about 1,000 more of those large tractors were sold in 2023 than were sold in 2024. And Tony, that's not a cheap piece of equipment. Farmers got to feel pretty good about their long-term prospects to make that kind of investment. And so that shows some real optimism. We see similar growth in combines. Combines are up 25% for the year, just about 1,000 more units sold in 23 than there were sold in 22. Again, considered purchase. So you're talking, $500,000 to $1 million, depending on the model of a combine. Again, farmers got to feel pretty good about their prospects to make those sorts of investment. So when you look at true row crop farmers, those are good numbers. Now, you also pointed out that softness, or you talked about that small tractor market. Small tractor market has just really been interesting for the last 5 years. During the pandemic, it was on fire. I mean, we couldn't sell enough of those because, consumers were home, spent a little bit more time on their acreage. That market seems to have been satisfied. And so when we look at the 2023 numbers for that particular market, it's actually down about 10%. It's down 10% from what was some pretty high numbers in 22 and even in 21. So I think overall, the overall outlook is really positive, despite some of these mixed bags in some of these smaller classes.
And he's quick to point out, this is one of the oldest fleets ever.
Tractors are just built to last, and we know that. And there's a lot of tractors that are, 50, 70 years old that are still operational today. And many of those, I know even on our farm, they just continue to operate, which is great. So it's a slightly different market. Having said that, we would also say that if you go on average, we're dealing with the oldest operational fleet in agriculture that we've ever dealt with. Well, what exactly does that mean? Well, this means that there's farmers hold onto their tractors, one more year. Having said that, good, progressive, profit-minded farmers are always looking to upgrade their fleet for the latest and greatest technology or operational efficiency, especially if you look at some of the later engines, or even including precision ag equipment. Later engines, if they have 20% more fuel efficiency, that makes a whole lot of economic sense to make an upgrade in equipment if you're saving 20% of your diesel that's costing over $5 a gallon. So those become some really interesting factors. Couple that with new precision agriculture equipment that's standard on newer tractors, or certainly easier to integrate in newer tractors. Those are motivating factors that go beyond sort of the typical life cycle that, I might have enjoyed when I was growing up on some of our tractors. So I think, comparing the two is very different. When you look at the small horsepower market, I think that is if you look at that 140 horsepower market, that's very much a consumer brand. Some of those tractors are being used, a whole lot. Some of them are simply being set idle quite a little bit because it's just working, a couple of landscaping projects on your acreage. I would say that as that demand is currently satisfied, those folks are going to be looking to replace those tractors in the next 3 to 5 years, and that'll sort of show some nice recovery in that market, for the next few years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are a number of phenomena that are impacting agricultural land ownership and investment in this country. I want to highlight a couple of them.
David Haight, Vice President of Programs with the American Farmland Trust on ownership and investment in U.S. farmland at a recent Farm Foundation forum.
First is changes that are happening in the farming and ranching community, particularly change in intergenerational transfers of farm and ranches. According to the 2017 Census of Agriculture, there were four times more senior farmers in this country than young farmers, and 40% of those senior operators did not identify a young farmer being involved in the ownership and or management of their farm. This is significant because farms that are at a time of transfer are vulnerable for many of these families. They're going to have to look outside the family for that next generation. Certainly, for some, this is a time when they can be lost to real estate development. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of acres. Senior farmers and landowners in this country own 370 million acres of agricultural land. So you could imagine in the next 20 years, there will literally be hundreds of millions of acres changing hands. At the same time, research from the United States Department of Agriculture, the American Farmland Trust, Farm Bureau, many others have identified barriers for beginning farmers and ranchers. One of the biggest being accessing land. It's hard to identify land that's available and is suited for the type of enterprise you might want to launch. Being able to afford the price of land because of competition. Or if leased land is available, being able to have lease terms that offer the type of security that a beginning farmer or rancher might need to be successful. So this transfer of farms from one generation to the next will literally reshape how hundreds of millions of acres are owned in this country. There's also a significant amount of land in this country that is owned by non-farmers and rented to farmers. The map that you see here is from the 2017 Census of Agriculture. It identifies the amount of rented land by county across the country. Overall, roughly 40% of the agricultural land in America is owned by non-farmers. This includes individuals like former farmers, family members of farmers, people that just bought land as individuals for different reasons, as well as institutional buyers. Certainly, it's not just the non-farmers that want to own land for and then rent it for agricultural purposes. There's also other non-farm buyers, people that want to own agricultural land and convert it to other uses. The American Farmland Trust released a report last year called Farms Under Threat 2040. It projects that roughly 18 million acres of agricultural land across this country is going to be fragmented, developed, paved over by 2040. This is not going to be spread equally around the country. It's particularly concentrated in states like Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, other parts of the Southeast. So this competition for land with other potential buyers is going to be a significant force that is going to be shaping land ownership patterns in the future.
David Haight, Vice President of Programs, American Farmland Trust. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The number of cattle on feed on October 1st was just under 11.6 million head, which was about 1% above a year ago, and would be the second highest October 1st inventory number since the series began in 1996.
Shel Shagham is a USDA livestock analyst.
During September, approximately 2.2 million head of cattle were placed on feed, which was about 6% above a year ago. Feedlots marketed just under 1.7 million head during September, which was about 11% below a year ago. But when we adjusted for the fact that there was one less slaughter day in September this year compared to last year, marketings were actually only about 6% below a year ago.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is a Kansas State livestock economist, talks about future feeding returns.
So each month, usually rough about the middle of the month, and I actually did this over the weekend in this case, I use information from the Animal Science and Industry Department along with market information for Kansas to put out historical as well as upcoming projections, you know, kind of net returns for cattle be leaving Kansas feed yards. And the punchline of what I just posted was, the remainder of this year, so through Christmas, we're projecting positive returns for steers that will be leaving yards. And then it's kind of a mixed bag as we go through, you know, the first half of 2024's projections. They are small losses to small gains compared to a month ago. These, at least on the front end, these first, you know, 4 or 6 months projections, they're a fair amount lower than they were before. So they are still in the realm of $200 per head. So historically, they're pretty good, but at least one of these was over $300 in the past. We've had a $7, if not a $9 per hundredweight pullback in the projected fed cattle price in the, you know, recent weeks that's underneath that. I'm interjecting that because there is a pullback in the market. But secondly, this entire series presumes no risk management. So it is, I pay cash for feeders, I pay cash for corn, I get cash for fed when I sell them. If you would have hedged, right, if you had cattle in the feed yard and you hedged 2 months ago, then you would have, quote unquote, locked in better returns. You would have protected yourself against higher incoming feeder cattle prices, but you may have missed out on some of the earlier run-up in fed cattle sales price. So, you know, the exact impact of this for your own operation matters on your own operations risk management plans. We include the break-even numbers as well as, you know, our kind of spot unhedged net returns. I know I just threw a lot at our folks there, but the main way to do this is tee it up, go look at the report, and I hope you find it helpful.
At the end of the day, though, supply and demand drive prices.
Supply and demand work together to tell us the price and quantity situation. And I am that ever dry economist that always talks about demand. But most of our listeners know I track meat demand, you know, beef, pork, chicken demand, multiple ways here at K-State. And the most lagged way I do it is, or the oldest information, is from USDA. And again, this past weekend, I updated what I could there. And the latest information we have solely from USDA that is not survey-based now goes through August. So people are following me on the lag here. The domestic situation is beef demand in August was up 3% versus August of 22. Pork demand was down 6% and chicken demand was down 6%. Beef and pork, for those measures, right, there's 8 months of information we have now here in 2023, have been down the vast majority. So beef was down all but 2 months in 23 so far. Pork was down all but one so far. Chicken's a mixed bag. So mixed bag on the demand story so far this year. When you look at export demand, so this is foreign demand for U.S. meat, beef demand was down 9% in August compared to August of 22. Pork and chicken were both up. And there's, you know, a very big difference is this is, you know, for over a year now consecutively, we had a pullback in foreign demand for U.S. beef. We were at some highs in affordability, you know, relative price on the global market, so forth, all come to play. And then we have over a year straight of pork demand growth in the foreign market, which is very much helping because pork producers are in the middle of some very challenging, you know, profitability challenges. It's nice to see that export demand growth. I'd like to see more because more is needed. But it's very much a tale of two different industries between beef and pork when we talk about the export market.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There's a lot of things we're working on to get credit out to customers better and more efficiently in rural America.
Ed Elfman's with the American Bankers Association.
Starting with the guaranteed loan increases, the Farm Service Agency guaranteed loan programs, I should say. We're looking to get both the farm ownership and farm operating programs increased. And why is that? Well, they're capped at a loan limit of $2.081 million right now. And when you start looking at the cost of agriculture and how much more it costs to be part of that, how much more capital it requires, we're really pushing to increase those limits so we can help more farmers get into farming or help them if times do turn sour for a little bit for them. But from a beginning farmer standpoint, if we don't get those loan increases, it's going to be really hard to buy land and buy equipment and get into agriculture, especially at a time when we're going to have some serious transition in agriculture over the next 5 to 10 years. Average age of the farmer goes up every single year. It's going to be harder and harder for this next generation if they don't have the proper capital to do it. So when we're looking at where the loan limits are now and where we'd like them to go, we'd like to get to $3.5 million on ownership and $3 million on operating. That would set our beginning farmers up especially to at least be able to compete with their neighbors and be able to get into the business of agriculture. It's not getting any cheaper. Missouri just had a new record land sale that surpassed Iowa. I think Missouri was, what, $36,000 an acre, $37,000 an acre to buy farmland? Well, we're talking about serious price and serious capital getting to ag. So that's our first priority, figuring out how to get that capital out to rural America, especially through the guaranteed farm ownership and farm operating programs.
One crop that's easier to get into is wheat, at least usually. Dan O'Brien's a Kansas State grain economist.
Wheat coming out of Europe that is priced to move, that needs to move, that can't just go into storage, is coming out onto the world markets. And not only coming into the U.S., but as that wheat substitutes pretty readily for hard red winter wheat, it is not just only coming into the U.S., but also going into other places in the world, competing very strongly with our U.S. product and puts us in not a very good competitive situation at this time. Is this the new norm? And I guess I'm beginning to think of it more like if we keep having a situation where as they grow crops over there in Ukraine and they come out quick on in the market and they're hard to compete with, it may be more like a Brazil soybean situation, to where eventually, yes, the U.S. does have some pretty good export markets, but we may have to wait, and the rest of the other sellers in the world may have to wait until these really cheaply priced to sell and move soybeans out of Europe get off the market, and then there'll be more room.
Simply put, the world wheat market is flooded.
The longer-term numbers are not that great. In fact, they're very, very tight, very poor, and it makes a hand-wringing economist, which I guess they pay us to wring our hands and to worry about things. I guess I have the attitude of this that we're really focusing myopically on just what's available right in front of us and really not seeing at all the challenges that are a little just beyond that. And the world wheat market's as tight as it's been since 2007, 2008, if the numbers aren't just off. So I guess the market may not recognize that until you'd have a drought in the Black Sea region. And those supplies, which are flooding the market from both Russia and Ukraine, you know, if they'd be shortened up, then what right now we're counting on, kind of myopically, again, just lots and lots of cheap wheat wouldn't be there. And then we'd look around and say, gosh, there's not a lot of wheat anywhere else either. So anyway, that's one way to try to piece at least my thoughts together on the world wheat market and what we're seeing right now.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
40% of the farm real estate in the United States is owned by somebody who doesn't farm it themselves.
Howard Halderman's president of Halderman Farm Management Services on who owns and is buying land.
Those are the clients the Halderman companies serve for the most part. We represent a lot of individual landowners. We represent some institutional farm landowners. And I would argue that they are an important component to United States agriculture in terms of the capital stack and land ownership.
There's a big focus right now on foreign ownership of land.
When we think about farmland, and these are dollar amounts, these aren't acres. David talked a lot about acres. I'm going to talk a little bit about dollar amounts to start out. But you can see I've got a map here of the United States. It's a little small, but these slides will be available, I believe, after the event if you want to dig in deeper into this. We break the country up into various regions. And there's $3.4 trillion in U.S. farm real estate. Of that, $1.9 trillion is cropland. That permanent and row. And out of that 1.9, you shrink that funnel down a little bit further. The 1.2 trillion is cropland in non-prohibited states. And you say, well, Howard, why is there a difference? Well, we represent absentee landowners and investment landowners who wish to acquire farmland. And if you look down the middle part of the country in the map, you'll see some states with white hatched lines. Those are states that today have some form of foreign ownership restriction. Sometimes it's foreign ownership foreign to the United States. Some of the restrictions are foreign to that state. So, for example, if you want to own land in the state of Missouri, I, as an individual living in Indiana, can do that. But my Indiana-based company or Indiana-based LLC cannot own land in the state of Missouri. That's state law. So every state has a little different variation to that has those hatch lines. But when we think about the investment universe, there's about $700 billion of cropland that's kind of locked away a little bit in those states that are prohibited to foreign ownership. And then you go down a little bit further. We look at water accessible cropland in the non-prohibited states. So where can we actually access water, either by natural rainfall or irrigation? That's about $1 trillion. And then out of that $1 trillion, there's only about $20 billion that sells each year. So I kind of thought this was helpful to put some metrics around when you think about farmland investment and what's actually available each and every year. One of the questions I've received throughout the winter, the But I went back, looked at foreign ownership of U.S. farmland, because all winter I did these seminars on farmland values. And every single seminar I got the question, well, Howard, how much land do the Chinese own? There's 40 million acres of farmland. Now, this is forest land included, so I kind of break that down there. 40 million acres total owned by foreign to the United States entities. As a comparison, the state of Illinois has 37 million acres total. So it's significant, right? 50%, roughly, of that 40 million acres is forest land, timberland. So, okay, that's not necessarily surprising, I don't think. But that 40 million acres represents 3.1% of all farmland. All right, 3.1%, not as significant as what we might originally think. And out of that 3.1%, Chinese ownership is only 1% of the total foreign owned. That was one that came out in the study that I picked out in December 31 of 2021, the Chinese ownership. They didn't break it down by others. Certainly, most of the foreign ownership here in the United States is going to be Western, EU, Australian, South American. Those are the most of the landowners that we see that are foreign to the U.S.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I will say I am much more optimistic about moisture for us in the first half of 2024 than I am for the back half of 24.
Brian Bledsoe is a meteorologist out of Colorado Springs.
I would be very judicious with your business practices and capitalize on that moisture while it's here, because as we know, living in the plains, we're never very far away from drought.
So could La Nina return?
That is a concern of mine, for the reasons of, in the Pacific Ocean, you have these warm and cold phases, and they are long-term. They are decadal cycles, if you will. And since 1998, the Pacific has been in a cold phase. And that's one of the major reasons why we have had to struggle more with drought over the past 25 years than we really had before then. As long as that Pacific stays cold, it makes it that much easier for us to go back into La Nina and for us to have to worry about drought and dryness again. The Pacific is still cold right now, despite the fact that El Nino is there, and that's one of the main reasons that I'm concerned about the back half of 24. It's a long ways out there, I get that, but when you look at how these patterns have cycled historically and kind of where we are right now, it's a red flag to me that we at least need to be addressing it and looking for that possibility.
One area dealing with drought, the Panama Canal. Oklahoma State's Dr. Sundaresh Haragu.
One of the things that the Canal Authority is doing now is to figure out how they can reuse the freshwater after it is used to lower or raise a ship. They are figuring out ways to reuse it. But, in the intermediate to long term, they're also looking at building a dam and diverting water from another river down into the canal. But that would require laying water pipes that run, 10, 15, 20 kilometers. All of this takes time. But the other, you asked about the cost, right? The costs have gone up somewhere between 30% and 45%. And shippers, like I said, are having to figure out which ones are they not going to include in their shipment because of the reduced weight requirements. Soybean transportation throughout has dropped by 50%. Just having a number of impacts. But in terms of other alternatives, I guess U.S. intermodal is one option. So I guess you could unload on the West Coast, for goods that are going from the Pacific to the Atlantic. You could unload them on the West Coast and then transfer them onto flatbed rail cars and ship them through. But then we always have to remember the cost, but also the capacity. If you put containers on a freight rail, you can only do 240 containers, whereas a cargo ship carries up to 15,000. So you'd probably need many more trains to transport the number of containers that you have in a ship. But the other solutions would be maybe looking at local sourcing, diversifying the sources of products that you get, whether it's agricultural or manufacturing, some closer to the source of consumption. If you were able to procure your goods, maybe that relieves some of the pressure on the canal until we tide this over and Mother Nature blesses Panama with more rain. These are some of the steps that we would have to take. Of course, the other thing I'll mention that's working against us is that the peak season for agricultural products transportation is the fourth quarter. And of course, that's also the holiday season. So there's going to be increased demand just from the natural cycle. And, you know, we're having to deal with increased demand but reduced capacity.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
As the average age of farmers approaches 60, the Farm Credit Administration and the ag lenders it regulates have for the last few years been wrestling with this question.
What can we do to help and assist young beginning and small farmers?
Farm Credit Administration Board Member Glenn Smith says the answer to that question is in some upcoming new rules for lender associations. Generally, the rules require lenders to improve their current young beginning and small farmer lending programs and to actively reach out to a more diverse group of potential borrowers. Now, yes.
Obviously, it's more efficient to go out and lend to a large, established, mega million-dollar operation as opposed to a dozen small loans, but in order to ensure the prosperity and the growth of future generations, we must have that outreach.
Smith says this is certainly not going to solve all the problems young farmers face.
But it is a good step in the right direction.
The new rules take effect February 1st. Gary Crawford, Washington.